headlines. Yemenis hold a mass rally in Sada'a to mark the 7th anniversary of the country's September 21 revolution. Australians take to the streets of the locked-down city of Melbourne, protest the shutdown of construction sites amid the coronavirus pandemic. Also in the headlines, rights groups slam the U.S. government for its planned expulsion of some 12,000, mostly Haitian migrants and asylum seekers. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Mies. Thanks for joining us. Yemenis in the northern city of Sada'a have marked the 7th anniversary of a revolution that they say ended U.S. hegemony in their country. The Yemenis rallied in Sada'a to mark the anniversary of the revolution that took place on September 21, 2014. Following the revolution, the government of former President Abu Rabbu Mansur Hadi collapsed. He was backed by Saudi Arabia, that even waged the ongoing war on Yemen to reinstate him. The current Yemeni government is made up of different groups, including Ansarullah, that has played a key role in defending the country. On Monday, Ansarullah leader Abdulmalik al-Houthi said the U.S. previously used al-Qaeda to advance its hegemonic agenda. He said the U.S. is now using Saudi Arabia and the UAE for the same purpose. The Taliban have named the remaining cabinet members of the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid made the announcement during a press conference in Kabul. He said there are no female ministers in the cabinet lineup. The Taliban announced their new leadership earlier in September, drawn up exclusively from loyalist ranks. That happened a month after the Taliban took power in Afghanistan, following sweeping territorial gains. After the takeover, the Taliban set an August 31 deadline for all foreign forces, including Americans, to leave Afghanistan. The withdrawal ended 20 years of war there. Most Lebanese lawmakers have given a vote of confidence to the new cabinet led by Prime Minister Najib Mikati. As observers say, given the economic collapse of Lebanon, the new cabinet's job will not be an easy one. Mariam Saleh reports.
A lengthy parliamentary session was held in Beirut to discuss the cabinet manifesto and give the Mikati cabinet a vote of confidence. The session began with an address by the Prime Minister, who briefed the members of parliament on the most significant issues which will be dealt with.
The socio-economic challenges should be among our top priorities. The government has no way but to put its focus on reforms to pave the way for uplifting the economy, developing the productive sectors, and attracting foreign investment. In addition to these files, we need to have an independent judicial body.
Prime Minister stressed that his cabinet will directly begin negotiations with the International Monetary Fund, and its main objective will include the general reforms and a restructuring of the banking sector. In light of Lebanon's current dire economic descent, the majority of Lebanese lawmakers decided to give a confidence vote to a cabinet which considers itself in a state of relief efforts.
We want to give Lebanon a chance to recover and to stop the collapse that is happening, the free fall that is happening, actually. And this is why we're giving it a chance, actually, based on also a program that we discussed with the Prime Minister and that included a lot of the requirements and the requests we have put in it.
Mikati's 24-member cabinet is also expected to offer solutions to shortages of medicine and fuel and to launch a social welfare card as a compensation for the local currency's lost value.
The government is expected to address all of these problems together, but they have to prioritize the problems. The Lebanese now, the mere Lebanese, the lay Lebanese, and the majority of the Lebanese are not capable of meeting their basic needs in order to survive. So we pin the hopes on the government to be able to prioritize the needs of the people and to address the most important. When we talk about the most important, we talk about the financial crisis, we talk about correcting the level of the wages for the Lebanese, and even to give a compensation so they can meet their basic needs.
The Mikati cabinet has vowed to prepare for parliamentary elections and hold them on time in May of 2022. The Mikati cabinet has stressed in its manifesto that now is the time for action and not words. The lawmakers, for their part, have considered that this government and all future cabinets must work on rebuilding the economy instead of relying on grants and loans. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
In recent weeks, Israel has been threatening to take military action against Iran, accusing it of seeking nuclear weapons. The Islamic Republic, however, has dismissed the accusations. It has warned of a crushing response to any act of aggression. Iran's defense minister has called the threats rants by enemies and said the country will defend itself.
Israeli officials have ramped up their anti-Iran rhetoric recently, accusing Tehran of seeking nuclear weapons and threatening the country with war. Israel's war of words against the Islamic Republic has intensified in recent months, especially after a deadly attack on an Israeli-managed tanker off the coast of Oman in July. Israel was quick to accuse Iran of carrying out the attack, pushing for a United Nations action against Tehran. This is while Iran has denied any involvement in the attack. On Monday, Iran's defense minister, Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Ashtiani, said Iran has repeatedly stressed that its defensive power and progress in new technologies and domestic innovations are meant to ensure national security and respond to any external aggression. He said the Islamic Republic of Iran is determined to confront the enemy on all fronts, adding that its enduring power will mark many other glorious victories.
I believe that the Zionists are trying to provoke Iran into some sort of first strike policy. If Iran strikes the Zionist entity first, and of course they will have reason in their opinion to call upon the Americans and the Europeans in order to protect them. Of course, I don't think that Iran will fall for this trap. I mean, they have been provoked for decades. They understand what is going on. But what Iran is most likely going to do is continuously support the resistance of the Palestinian people, of the Syrian people, of the Lebanese people, etc., against the Zionist entity.
Taking a swipe at the Israeli regime, Brigadier General Ashtiani said Tel Aviv is resorting to accusations against Iran out of desperation. Also responding to the accusations, Iran's ambassador to the Vienna-based international organizations, Kazem Gharibabadi, said while Tehran has been cooperating with the International Atomic Energy Agency, the world body has been in the dark about Israel's nuclear activities for well over five decades.
Apart from hostile actions against Iran, Israel has increasingly targeted positions belonging to the resistance in the Gaza Strip, Syria, and Lebanon. That begs the question, is the regime in Tel Aviv seeking an all-out war with multiple nations? That won't be a wise choice for Israel, considering that the regime couldn't claim victory even in its 11-day war on the besieged Gaza Strip earlier this year.
The escalation of tensions between Iran and the regime in Tel Aviv comes amid a stalemate in talks aimed at reviving the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, also known as the Iran nuclear deal. The U.S. government unilaterally withdrew from the 2015 deal in May 2018, despite Iran complying fully with its commitments under the deal. Many rounds of talks between Tehran and other remaining signatories to the accord were held recently in the Austrian capital, Vienna, without any definite breakthrough. Iran maintains that the Americans must make the first move by removing sanctions and carrying out all their obligations under the deal. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden, under the pressure of the Israeli regime, has so far failed to honor its commitments of reversing measures taken by the Trump administration. Meanwhile, Iran isn't the only country Israel holds animosity toward. Apart from attacking Iran's nuclear scientists and sites, the regime has been carrying out raids against resistance groups in the region, particularly in Syria and Lebanon.
The core principle, of course, of the Zionist entity of Israel is that they are always trying to provoke their neighbors and wider nations as well, not even their immediate neighbors in the Islamic and Arab world in general, into further conflicts. Either amongst themselves or, of course, with the Israeli military. Now, in case of Iran, there is this growing regional powerhouse that has been developing a resistance factor in the area known as the Middle East since 1979, since the Islamic Revolution there. And this is something that has gradually started worrying Israel and the United States and much of Europe, of course.
What officials in Tel Aviv need to consider is how they can provoke war with multiple sides while they couldn't confront attacks launched by the impoverished and besieged Gaza Strip in May.
Australian police have clashed with demonstrators protesting against mandatory COVID vaccination for the construction workers in the city of Melbourne. Riot police used pepper spray and rubber ball grenades to break up the protests. The demonstrators lit flares and attacked police cars. At least three officers were injured. Over 40 protesters were also arrested. Melbourne officials have shut down construction sites for 2 weeks, linking them to several COVID clusters. All construction workers are also required to get one vaccine dose by the end of this week. The Australian city has been under a lockdown for 7 weeks as it struggles to curb an outbreak of the COVID Delta variant. The United Nations has voiced concern at the U.S. deportation of mostly Haitian refugees massing along the Mexican border. The U.N. Human Rights Office called disturbing the images of transportation of migrants to the Haitian capital, Port-au-Prince. Expressed disappointment that there have apparently not been any individual assessments of the cases by the U.S. The U.N. Refugee Agency also voiced concern at deportations or expulsions, saying that people who have a fear of persecution in their homeland, including Haiti, have a right to file for asylum. American rights groups have also demanded a halt to the deportations. More than 12,000 refugees have arrived at the U.S. border in recent weeks. Some of them have already been sent back to Haiti. Expulsions are taking place under a health order, citing the coronavirus pandemic. The Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's Liberal Party is projected to win the country's hotly contested elections for the lower house of parliament. According to TV projections, the Liberals are leading in 155 electoral districts nationally. However, they looked set to fall short of the 170 seats needed to hold a majority at the lower house of parliament. Canada's opposition Conservatives have already conceded defeat in the elections. Prime Minister Trudeau called the vote 2 years early in the hope of winning the majority that he lost in the 2019 elections. Final results are still days away, with the pandemic and a delay in counting mail-in votes hampering the process. Author and commentator Yves Engler says the election was a failed bet for Trudeau, as his party falls short of a majority win. Engler also believes any change in government would not have brought any real change in Canada's policy.
Basically, Trudeau wanted a majority. He had a minority government. He wanted a majority. He thought that this was his best chance to do that due to a whole series of factors with regards to upcoming elections at the provincial and municipal levels. And basically, what he got was exactly what he had beforehand. The political parties are in agreement on spending over $100 billion on new naval vessels and fighter jets. The political parties are kind of slightly varying amount of wanting to get tough on China. You know, the Trudeau government promised to restart diplomatic relations with Iran that were ended by the previous conservative government. They promised that back in 2015. They haven't moved forward on that. None of the opposition parties criticized the Liberals for that. Foreign policy was little discussed during the election, and the differences between the different parties is very minimal. Now, the Conservatives, lost the second party in the country. They are even more extreme. They wanted to move Canada's embassy to Jerusalem. They wanted to, get even more tough on Iran, even more tough on China. So it's good that they didn't win. The Liberals are maybe slightly better, a slightly less bad foreign policy than the Conservatives. But really, the difference between the five parties on relations to the rest of the world is unfortunately very minimal.
Iran has reported 379 more coronavirus-related fatalities, taking the overall death tally to nearly 118,000 since the start of the pandemic. Health Ministry officials say that more than 17,000 new infections were also registered in the past day, bringing the total caseload to over 5.4 million. The virus continues to take its toll on Iran despite a massive vaccination drive across the country, with more than 45 million doses of jabs administered so far. Iran experienced the fifth peak of COVID-19 in mid-August, with the number of daily infections then standing at over 50,000 and related deaths at over 700. The Delta variant of COVID-19 was blamed for the surge. Muslims are descending on Iraq's holy city of Karbala ahead of the day of Arbaeen. Pilgrims will join the annual gathering that marks the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. This year, Ibrahim falls on September 28th. The event drew millions of people in the past years. But the Iraqi government has restricted the number of foreign visitors since last year due to the pandemic. Imam Hussein and dozens of his companions were martyred in an unequal battle with troops of the tyrant ruler of their time over 13 centuries ago. The battle, known as Ashura event, is one of the most important religious occasions marked by Muslims. Now to Sudan, where the government says it has foiled a coup attempt in the capital, Khartoum. Information Minister Hamza Balul says all those behind the failed coup have been busted. Balul says the attempted putsch has been staged by what he calls the remnants of the former regime led by ousted President Omar al-Bashir. According to the minister, those taken into custody involve military officers and civilians. Government sources earlier said the plotters tried to take over the state media building, but they failed. Sudan is currently ruled by a transitional government composed of both civilian and military representatives. It was installed after Bashir was toppled in April 2019 following months of street protests. The UN Secretary General has called for international action to avert what he describes as a climate catastrophe.
My message this morning and to the Conference of Parties in November is that we need decisive action now to avert climate catastrophe. And for that, we need solidarity. Saving these and future generations is a common responsibility.
Guterres also warned that with the current carbon emission levels, the world is on track to witness 2.7 degrees Celsius annual warming. That's almost double the temperature needed to avoid irreversible disasters, as outlined in the 2015 Paris Climate Accord. The UN chief called on the world's richer nations to deliver on their commitments toward a $100 billion per year climate fund to help developing countries deal with climate change. He made the remarks during a meeting with British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. The discussions were held ahead of a two-week climate summit, which will be hosted by the UK starting from October 31st. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Imam Khamenei's televised speech addressing the new wave of coronavirus, August 13, 2021. In any case, efforts should be intensified for both imports and for national manufacture so that officials could provide the vaccine for the people in whatever way possible. Millions of vaccines should become accessible. The next issue is about medication. I've heard that pharmacies and hospitals are lacking in medication, or that medicines are hard to find, but that they are available in the black market at a several times higher price. If this is true, this shows the existence of a fundamental problem in the distribution network. This should be seriously confronted and prevented. Medicines should easily be within the people's reach. The next point is the cooperation of the military forces. In the first months, when the disease had just appeared, the military forces, whether the army or the IRGC, seriously entered the arena and accomplished great feats. The siege cooperated very well. Although they are active in the present time as well, they should use their full potential and help the people. These are the tasks that fall on officials and that are really necessary. They should show no consideration for anyone. I'm not saying this in particular about imposing a lockdown because this is an expert matter and should be examined in the National Anti-Coronavirus Headquarters. However, if they reach a certain conclusion, they should certainly implement it in a firm and decisive manner. As for the people, well, our dear people are faced with this bitter problem. But part of the problem results from the people not observing the protocols. It is said that in some cities, people observe only 35% or 40% of the protocols. Well, this is too little. The people should observe the protocols 100%. Even if some people cannot put on a mask and correctly observe social distancing and the like, the majority of the people should observe them completely. This is a problem that originates from us. If we ourselves do not observe the protocols, we risk our own life and that of others, in particular that of our family members and people close to us. Therefore, part of the problem results from the violation of these protocols. The people should continue to be as sensitive and careful as they were in the first months when the disease had just appeared.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
On August 15th, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau dissolved the parliament and called a snap election. Now, Canadians are preparing to cast their ballot in the 2021 federal election on September 20th to elect members of the 44th Canadian Parliament. Polls show that the Liberal Party, led by the current Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, and the Conservatives, led by leader Erin O'Toole, are neck and neck in the race, as they are both predicted to win 32% of the national popular vote. Therefore, it is a type of election where Canadian Muslim voter groups can make a difference, as they account for 3.2% of the country's population. Muslims are mainly concerned about Islamophobia. Canada has suffered from more mass killings motivated by Islamophobia in the last 5 years than any other country in the G7. Since 2017, 11 Canadian Muslims have been killed in 3 deadly attacks driven by Islamophobia. The 2017 Quebec City mosque mass killing is one example, which has been the worst anti-Muslim mass murder incident in Canadian history.
Well, it's certainly out of character for most Canadians, but there is a right-wing segment of Canadian society that has gained legitimacy from the actions and words of U.S. President Donald Trump. So the Conservative Party has generally been sort of very pro-Israeli, anti-Muslim, and anti-Palestinian, and has attacked people who have expressed support for the Palestinians, claiming that they're somehow anti-Semitic.
Islamophobia is a problem deeply rooted in Canada's social and political fabric. Experts believe that the federal leaders lack what is needed to fully address the rise of hatred and systematic discrimination in this country. According to one victim, the political leadership is responsible for allowing this polarization to take place, and the years of public discourse have created this anti-Muslim hate. The Liberal Party of Canada has vowed to create a national support fund to help survivors of hate crimes. It also wants to update the federal anti-racism strategy by 2022 and approve new legislation to combat this spread of online hate. Meanwhile, the New Democratic Party and the Conservative Party have promised to tackle online hate as well. However, there is no mention of Islamophobia or racism in the major political party's entire platform. During their campaign trail, none of the Canadian major political parties held public events to address racism and Islamophobia. Also, despite all having platform planks on the issue, when questioned, none of them explained why they haven't done that.
Trudeau was always balanced and kept a Canada-independent policy. His son Justin actually has been very fair and supportive of the Muslim community, even though he has been attacked by right-wing members of the politics and also in the media. So he has actually taken some flack for taking stance in support of the Muslim community, but he has not been able to make the change for Israel, where he's still anti-Palestinian and still very much beholden to the pro-Zionist lobby in Canada.
Canadian Muslims urged their leaders to take measures to combat Islamophobia, as it has resulted in deadly attacks and rising anti-Muslim hatred. However, Canadian politicians have for years failed to do so, since they see Muslims as only potential vote-getting opportunities that belong on their platforms.
The Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, has approved documents for Iran's full membership at the Eurasian Political, Economic, and Security Alliance. The decision came as the 21st summit of the organization opened in Dushanbe earlier in the day. The Islamic Republic joined the SCO in 2005 as an observer state.
SCO, with the current membership, covers close to 50% of the world population and about one-third of the world's GDP. Being a member of this organization will take a lot of pressure away in terms of Western sanctions, Western impositions, monetary manipulations via the US dollar as a remedy for payment. No more.
Leaders from 8 member states and 4 observer states attended the annual summit in Tajikistan's capital on Friday, with the Chinese leader Xi Jinping addressing it virtually along with Russian president. Xi criticized sanctions imposed on world economic exchanges, urging the SCO members to stay united against attacks by other countries. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi and his counterpart from Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, Belarus, Pakistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan attended in person. Addressing the summit, President Raisi said the world today has entered a new era when hegemony and unilateralism are declining.
The world is entering a new era with a new order,
domination and unilateralism are on the decline. International order is moving toward multipolarization and redistribution of power in favor of independent states.
The Iranian president also underlined that sanctions are preventing regional cooperation and urged the SCO to define mechanisms to fight these challenges. In his address at the SCO summit, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi described sanctions as economic terrorism and the hegemonic power's most important tool to impose their own will on the others. He warned that unilateral sanctions are not limited to one country, but as it has become clear in recent years, they include more independent countries, particularly the SCO member states. Two key members of the alliance, Russia and China, have also come under sanctions from the West. Ties between Washington and Beijing deteriorated after former U.S. President Donald Trump took office in 2017, waging an economic war against China. While many expected the current administration of Joe Biden to mark a departure from Trump's hawkish policies, it adopted a tougher stance against China and Russia, imposing several rounds of sanctions on them on various pretexts.
Western trade currency restrictions do not exist in the SCO member countries. This will drastically reduce the potential for Western sanctions and will increase, on the other hand, Iran's potential to deal with the East, for example, or especially China and Russia, entering partnership agreements with these and other SCO countries, benefiting from comparative advantages.
At the end of the summit, SCO member states signed the Dushanbe Declaration, in which they stress opposition to interference under the excuse of counterterrorism or human rights, or solving key international and regional issues through small cliques, ideology, or confrontation mentality. They also agreed on strengthening cooperation in cracking down on terrorism, extremism, and separatism, and reached a consensus in supporting building an inclusive government in Afghanistan.
The Israel regime has reportedly started a cyber sabotage campaign in the UAE to interfere with the regional air and maritime navigation in West Asia.
Cyber warfare is becoming more and more important and more dangerous as well. So Israel wants to take advantage of any opportunities there.
The campaign seeks to disrupt the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman region's air and maritime navigation systems, thus destabilizing the regional security situation. On the other hand, the bid seeks to transit the focal point of crisis away from the occupied territories towards the region and therefore reduce the political and security pressure faced by the regime's ruling body. The UAE has signed dozens of memorandums of understanding with Israel since it became the first Arab state to normalize ties with Israel this century.
Israel sees itself with the Sunni monarchies and the conservatives as their potential allies in this. So it wants to be able to conduct the kind of cyber sabotage and infiltration that is becoming so important, so much more important. So it's not surprising that they would do this when they have the opportunity, and the UAE is providing that opportunity for them.
Israel has said that it expects $1 billion in trade with the UAE by the end of 2021 and $3 billion in 3 years. The UAE aims to raise the value of economic activity with Israel to more than $1 trillion in the next 10 years. According to regional observers, at the heart of the UAE's desire to normalize ties with the regime in Tel Aviv was its penchant for U.S.-made F-35 fighter jets, which the peace deals with Israel, known as the Abraham Accords, made possible. To the Persian Gulf state, established full diplomatic relations with the Tel Aviv regime in a deal brokered by the former U.S. President Donald Trump. Shortly after the deal was reached, the Trump administration authorized the sale of 50 advanced F-35 fighter jets to the UAE. The UAE and Israel are reportedly deepening their ties and espionage activities in the region. The UAE has helped Israel set up a center for military and maritime reconnaissance on the strategic Yemeni island of Socotra. The Red Crescent Society of the United Arab Emirates has signed a contract with the Tel Aviv regime in order to create an intelligence center for the Israeli Air Force at Socotra Airport. Socotra is home to some 60,000 people. It overlooks the Bab el-Mandab Strait, a main shipping route that connects the Red Sea to the Gulf of Aden and the Arabian Sea. It also has a unique ecosystem, which is already being exploited by the Emiratis. The mission reportedly aimed at collecting information from across the Gulf of Aden, including Bab el-Mandab and south of Yemen, which is under the control of forces backed by the UAE. Socotra has been a source of tensions between the UAE and Saudi Arabia. They have been jockeying for position for control of the island's unique resources in the absence of a powerful government in Yemen amid a ferocious war on the country. Back in June 2020, UAE-backed separatists of the so-called Southern Transitional Council, or the STC, took control of Socotra.
As you know, Israel has always welcomed the opportunity to have alliances within what it has considered to be the enemy camp, namely the Arabs. And in the opportunity with an alliance is to profit in various ways, to build one's power through espionage.
A new security pact involving the United States, Britain, and Australia has triggered controversy and condemnation. The U.S. and U.K. announced this week that they will provide Australia with advanced technology to build nuclear-powered submarines. Based on their agreement, Australian naval forces will have atomic submarines that are much faster as they use nuclear propulsion systems and harder to detect than conventional fleets. They can spend months under the sea and target longer distances with their missiles. The leaders of the three countries hailed the new deal as a step that will make it easier to counter threats in the Indo-Pacific. They repeatedly mentioned regional security concerns, which they said had grown significantly. None of them mentioned China, but the pact is being widely viewed as an initiative to counter Chinese influence in the region, including in the contested resource-rich South China Sea.
Well, there are two elements here. One is the fact that this alliance could be a new version of NATO for Indo-Pacific region, and the other is that this purchase of nuclear-powered submarine could be an initial step to transfer more technology to nuclear technology to Australia, maybe in the long term having Australia acquiring nuclear bomb capacity.
The United States and its allies make no secret of their intensified efforts to try to contain the growing Chinese influence and power there. Many observers believe the newly announced deal is in line with those efforts. Meanwhile, the development is expected to further sour relations between Beijing and Canberra. In recent years, political tensions have grown between the two over a number of issues, including Australia's stance against Chinese telecom giant Huawei. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Xiao Lijian criticized what he called the U.S.-led alliance's obsolete Cold War mentality and warned the three countries against moves that would hurt their own interests. Some Chinese media went so far as to say that Australia had now turned itself into an adversary of China. What are the implications of this new pact and other moves against China for regional and international security? Meanwhile, China was not the only party infuriated by the new security pact. France condemned it too. That is because Australia will now scrap a deal with France to buy a dozen conventional submarines worth tens of billions of dollars. France's Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian called Australia's agreement with the U.S. and the U.K. a stab in the back. France said the development underscored the need to bolster a, quote, European strategic autonomy. The United States and arch-rival China may have toned down their rhetoric against each other, but tensions between the two superpowers are simmering as they remain deeply engaged in an intense global rivalry. There are many flashpoints in their testy relationship, including tensions in the South China Sea and the issue of Taiwan. America has made it clear that its military will maintain a strong presence in the Indo-Pacific, where the U.S. has been trying to contain the growing influence of its arch-rival. America seems determined to follow policies aimed at containing the Chinese influence worldwide. And with China absolutely unwilling to back down, tensions are expected to mount in the coming years.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran. big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss problems, issues, and other relevant questions parents have when raising their children in an Islamic way. The answers are, as usual, all based upon the Holy Quran and the narrations of the Prophet and of the household of the Prophet, peace be upon them all. Joining us is our guest speaker, Sayyid Abdullah al-Musawi, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sayyid. Today's topic is about disciplining our children. How should we go about disciplining them in a productive and perhaps a humane and effective way?
A'udhu billahi minash shaitan rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa anjil faraju. Before we talk about disciplining children, discipline itself, as a term, we use it to bring attention of the child to something that he done wrong, or right, to a behavior that we don't like. And sometimes it serves as a painful reminder for what he did. Now, there are ways, and there are principles, and there are, you know, as we say, fundamentals to the laws and rules of trying to punish a child. One thing for sure, that when it comes to punishment, most people, the thing that comes to their mind when it comes to punishing the children, the first thing that they would do is resort to hitting the child. Right. That's the first thing that people do when it comes to disciplining their children. The child does something wrong, the parents get angry, and the first thing he would do is he'd hit his child.
It's a knee-jerk reaction. The first thing
is an immediate
think about.
reaction, which indicates, to some extent, some might be take offense to what I'm about to say, but to some extent is
the maturity
an act
of
ignorance. You know, that when a person hits his child, it's an act of ignorance.
Right.
Because a child, if you think that will have an effect, then you're mistaken. That would actually have a reaction, an opposite reaction, and the effect will be short term.
So it's backfires.
He would stop fun now, but guess what? Next time is going to be double, triple. That's how the human body works. That's how the human mind works. So a lot of people don't understand that what they do is actually make the children worse. So when it comes to discipline, a person has to keep in mind that the more he disciplines his child, the worse he makes him, not the better that he makes him.
Is this a rule of thumb, or is it just...
It is a rule of thumb.
Okay.
Yeah, the more you punish a child, the worse he becomes. Because human being, their nature, we're rebellious in our nature.
Right.
Yeah, we always start to rebel from Allah and downwards.
Right.
So we have this nature that we mentioned that the child, especially a child, is in the process of building his own personality, creating his own identity. When this identity is in the process of the making, and it gets hurt, it gets insulted, then he would replace the bricks of his personality with what is meant to be, was something that shouldn't be.
Right.
For example, if he was growing to be a nice, soft child, now he's being hit, now he's being insulted, he has rage now, he has anger, he has hate. He will use that.
So these negative feelings he will use to build himself up.
Yeah, so he would use the wrong materials to build the wrong person. By the time he becomes in his teenage years, he would have a troubled child. And then you say, well, what did I do wrong? Well, nothing. He just slapped him many times. So he haven't done much.
Not really nothing.
Yeah, so that kind of play and that kind of questioning always brings a negative effect to the child.
And on that note, dear listeners, we will take a quick break.
When I was born, the first words that I had heard were the words of Allah being whispered through my ear. And as I felt Allah's presence in my soul, that day Islam took me in its fold.
Welcome back to your listeners. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing how to correctly discipline our children in an effective manner. Dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion.
So we said that disciplining a child, obviously, if the first thing that comes to your mind is hitting your child and trying to hurt your child, then as a, you know, as a reaction or out of anger, then obviously not only going on the wrong way about doing it, but you're actually doing more damage to the child than doing any good.
Right.
Second thing that we need to keep in mind when it comes to also trying to punish our children or discipline our children is that let's educate the child themselves before. I think we made that point clearer in episodes to come, that we need to educate the child before we punish them. There are, you know, many ways we can educate. And even if we want to, let's say, discipline our child, there are over 50 different ways of disciplining a child.
So that does not, it's not require, only hitting.
Yeah, so that does not require us, you know, hitting or going taking extreme measures. There are many, many ways that we can use in order to make the child correct his mistake and correct his behavior, especially just by becoming, you know, becoming his friend. Just giving that friendly feeling that sometimes when you do something wrong and your friend comes and tells you, look, this is wrong, usually we listen to our friends. Because of course, we have this special bond between them and between us and them, so we try to solve. But if your friend just comes and just yells at you, tells you off, obviously you're going to not, you know, you, we will take offense.
You're going to be receptive at least to the feedback, at the very, very least.
Exactly. So when it comes to them and our children, we have to keep these things in mind. And the younger they are, obviously, the worse it becomes. So, first thing happens when we discipline a child, because we try to understand how discipline works, first and foremost, before we go on to the methods of discipline.
Right.
Is that when a child is disciplined, the first thing that happens to him, it kills his IQ when it comes to his intellect, when it comes to his ability to think and become creative, that will become a lot worse. How so? So if you run out of patience and you don't have patience, and the first thing that you do, you slap your child once a day, twice a day, or at least twice a week, three times a week. So when the child faces this, when he faces this state of pain inside him, he will be constantly thinking of other things to calm himself down. So he tries to find out why he's feeling so miserable in trying to be with his parent. Right. So his mind and his entire brain, his mentality will shift to somewhere else. For example, we've seen this many times when you have kids at school who are traumatized in their houses, they can't concentrate in class. They can't create, they cannot think, because his mind is constantly busy. For example, if a child gets beaten a few times a week, most of the times he will think, when will I be beaten again?
Right.
So he is living in a fear.
He will be preoccupied with that.
Yeah, so his thinking, his intellect will obviously fly away.
Yeah, that makes sense. And on that note, they'll say it, we will take a quick break.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, "A righteous child is indeed a flower from the flowers of paradise."
Welcome back to your listeners. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we're discussing how we should correctly discipline our children. Dear Sayyid, please further enlighten us.
All right, so we said the first thing happens to the child, that his creativity, his intellect, his smartness, obviously, will go away. And this is according to a lot of studies that have been done, that if a child is hit once or twice a week, they've noticed that their mark or their school grade, it just dropped dramatically, because now they have other traumas, now they have other fears, now they're thinking about something
else.
They
can't really concentrate.
Yeah,
you
can't.
Study.
So studying, it's going to be one of their secondary things in life, they won't concentrate about it. Also, when we look at discipline, and especially when it comes to body discipline, many studies show that When kids gets hit and disciplined by their parents, one of the things that happens to children is that they become more, they would have more hate. They would become more vicious and angry themselves.
Resentful.
Yeah, resentful themselves. They would have hate towards other people because, like I said before, once they feel that they're not being respected, so they try to project whatever they have in their hearts towards other people. And sometimes you might have seen this with kids, with families who have like siblings. One of the child get hit. When he gets hit, he gets so angry and so, I don't know, I don't want to use that term. He goes and he hits his own brother.
He lashes out on his other siblings as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, he takes it out on other people.
Right.
Or sometimes the father hits him, he goes hits the mother.
Right.
So this happens constantly. It's because he has this, you know, animosity now. He's just building a monster inside of him.
He needs to release it. And he doesn't know how to correctly release it.
Exactly. So he wants to take it out on other people. So this is the first thing that happens to a child when he has this. So this becomes a seed that grows and grows until we have, I don't know, murderers in society. Mm. We have
it bad becomes a personality trait as well.
Yeah, yeah. So this happens, right?
Right.
And also he starts to have the feelings of, you know, that shame. He feels that he's, you know, always lives in this state of fear, shame, and anger from within himself. Like right. He has even towards himself, he has anger and shame. Why did my parents hate me? What did I do wrong? I didn't do anything wrong. And then he, you know, constantly he starts to eat himself within. So it affects him when it comes to him dealing with other people, and it also affects him when it comes to him dealing with himself. So that's something that parents should keep in mind when they want to discipline children, or especially because even we say that when a parents want to discipline child, most of the times, if not all the times, that the parents, they themselves are trying to seek revenge
right.
for themselves. So, I mean, why would you go to the extreme to hit a child or yell at a child or cause them pain? Isn't it because you have anger? And anger, where does anger originate from? Is that someone done something to you?
Some injustice or something.
Yeah, so someone done something to you and that you feel like you're insulted and you're trying to take revenge back. But now you're taking revenge back on a poor child. Or your own child.
When you put it that way, it is extremely messed up.
Yeah, it is messed up. That's why that you see that all the studies that have been done that shows that such an action should not happen, and especially in Islam. Islam, if you look at the hudud or the qisas, the punishment, if you hit a child, if the skin changes yellow, right. you have to pay a certain amount of gold. If it changes red, you have to pay extra. If it changes black, you have to pay even extra. And this becomes a debt on the father that he needs to pay the child.
To that degree, Islam is careful.
Yeah, so Islam says don't even hit them, because sometimes like if you hit a person, you can see that the skin straight away changes color.
Right.
So it depends on the strength, it will change. And then Islam says you need to pay.
Naturally.
So Islam takes it seriously.
Of course. You need to recompensate this child that you hurt.
Of course.
Dear Sayyid, we must end today's program, unfortunately, because we are out of time. I thank the dear listeners for joining us on our program. As usual, if our dear listeners have any questions, comments, or some feedback, they can contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. Alternatively, you can also find us on various social media, such as on Instagram and Facebook, under the call handle of Call of Islam Radio. Thank you for tuning in. Until another program, fi amalillah.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
Media Stream.